one of the main competitor jurisdictions for Alaska is the lower 48, and what we see there is significantly lower government take.
Another consultant weighs in on oil tax reform. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, April 23rd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a Supreme Court case that has big implications for Alaska tribes.
The U.S. Chamber of Commerce and the National Defense Industrial Association joined in the case on the side of the tribes, which is a very strange alliance.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. The Association of Alaska School Boards believes that all students should be proficient in reading, writing, and math by the time they finish the third grade. More information at aasb.org. This message sponsored by the Association of Alaska School Boards.
Lawmakers in the State House of Representatives appear cautious but open to Governor Parnell's new oil tax plan. The bill is now being heard in the Resources Committee, where members, through their economic consultants, are taking a show-me approach to cutting taxes. In reviewing the state's current tax regime, ACES, Janik Mayer of PFC Energy told the committee today that it works well for a taxing entity where the money earned from production is invested elsewhere. He called that a harvest system and compared the tax to rent, when the state gets the most money it can from declining production.
One of the main competitor jurisdictions for Alaska is the lower 48 as a destination for cash. And what we see there is significantly lower government take, which is one of the things that makes it harder at the moment in the current climate for Alaska to compete within companies' portfolios for investment dollars.
Mayer told the committee that the decision to harvest Alaska's oil was a decision made several years ago at the corporate level of oil companies, and it was based on conditions at that time. Committee co-chair Paul Seaton, a Republican from Homer, said if changing the tax structure would really make a difference. Mayer explained the decision was not abstract. It is based on the best use of investment money at the time.
If I understand it correctly, the point you're getting at is to say this was a place that the companies in net were taking cash out of long before ACES was in place. And I'd agree that's certainly the case. One just has to go back and look at the financial statements. And this was not a cash deficit region. This was a cash surplus region for some time in the past. That's absolutely true. And in that sense, I certainly wouldn't suggest that the imposition of ACES has somehow created a harvest system where none existed before.
Mayer said the industry has seen other changes since ACES was put in place. Oil prices are higher and technology has opened up new resources. And the growth in the lower 48 was completely unimagined at the time. Committee co-chair Eric Feige, a Republican from Chickaloon, said the harvest decision predates ACES and was based on a combination of factors that members need to consider.
Price of oil was relatively low. The state was obviously feeling the pinch in the 02, 03, 04 timeframes as a result. But then as the price started to rise, the tax regime was changed to take an increasingly greater and greater take. I guess the question to answer for us is, what's driving the train here? Is it the actual field mechanics, or is the tax of the fiscal regime driving it into harvest mode when it could be something else?
The committee has scheduled two hearings per day for the rest of this week, with no schedule for handing the bill off to the Finance Committee. Meanwhile, the Senate Resources Committee is not scheduling hearings until the administration presents information requested by the committee last week. Tribal organizations in Alaska and across the country are anxiously waiting for a decision in a case just argued before the U.S. Supreme Court. Salazar versus Rama Navajo seeks to overturn a lower court ruling that found in favor of tribes when the BIA didn't fully fund law enforcement contracts. 75 tribal groups in Alaska and 260 tribes in other states are waiting for the decision. The case will also impact contract funding disputes for the Indian Health Service. Lloyd Miller is one of the attorneys representing tribes in the matter. He says when 12 regional BIA offices with varying degrees of competency are working through appropriation shortfalls for tribal contracts, some tribes get underpaid and others get overpaid. He says the key to the case is a decision that's more than a century old.
That case was decided in 1892 at a time when the Corps of Engineers had an amount of money from Congress and awarded contracts to do work on a river in Pennsylvania. And then when it came time to pay the contractor, the agent who had the money didn't have the money. He had over-obligated the appropriation. He'd signed too many contracts for too much money. And the court said, that's a problem for the government, but it's not a problem for the contractor. So the court said, look, if you're a contractor dealing with the United States, you can count on the United States to pay you. So long as there's enough money in the statute. And the statute, as I'm saying here, the statute appropriates $100 million. It's plenty to pay most everybody. Not quite everybody, it turns out, but most everybody. And you ought to be able to count on that. That's the Ferris Doctrine. What's interesting in the case is that the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and the National Defense Industrial Association joined in the case on the side of the tribes, which is a very strange alliance. They may or may not care a lot about tribal rights. What they do care a lot about is the integrity of government contracts. I mean, behind those names are Boeing and General Electric, Lockheed. I mean, the great contractors of the United States that deal with the military-industrial complex of America, and they count on contracts being paid. And if the government is right, it means that if their appropriation is just $1 short, they can do anything they want with their appropriation because they've done it. They can overpay Lockheed, underpay Boeing. There's no holds barred in what the government can do because they have done this, and they're defending the integrity of what they did, which was a completely mad system in which tribes are overpaid and underpaid for absolutely no reason, no good reason.
So if I understand it correctly, after the Ferris Doctrine, then the government sort of covered that by having all contracts with the government say, subject to available appropriations. Is that correct?
All contracts are subject to available appropriations. It's in fact, there's an ancient law called the Anti-Deficiency Act, which really reflects that. It means that the government cannot sign a contract that would require more money to be paid than is appropriated. What happens, though, when the rule is broken? I mean, the government agent might get disciplined, might go to jail. All sorts of things could happen to the contracting officer who works for the government. But what happens to the contractor? Does the contractor still have a right to be paid for the work the contractor did for the government? Well, you would think yes, unless the contractor had some reason to know that the government agent was acting illegally. Well, that would be a different story. But when the contractor has no reason to know, then this idea that contracts are subject to the availability of an appropriation to pay you has no role to play.
Can the Supreme Court really fix this, or does Congress have to go back and do it?
The Supreme Court can take care of the past. It cannot take care of the future. The Supreme Court can say, as I think they should, that in this sort of a situation where two immovable forces meet, the tribes are entitled to be compensated for the work they actually did. For the future, it's really up to Congress.
What's at stake for the tribes in Alaska going forward?
When I think of these agreements, it's impossible if you work in the field of Native American law not to think of treaties. And it's been said often that there is no treaty in existence that wasn't broken. In the modern era, these contracts are the substitute for treaties. And the Supreme Court told us a few years ago in an earlier case involving the Cherokee Nation that these contracts were going to be different. These were real contracts, truly binding, with mutual obligations. You could sue if there's a breach. My concern is that the Supreme Court will adopt some other rule that makes it look like a treaty again that can be breached with impunity. I think that's what's at stake for the tribal providers of law enforcement and health care and realty services and probate services in Alaska and outside.
Lloyd Miller is an attorney in Anchorage and Washington, D.C. He says it was very difficult to gauge which way the justices may rule in the case. A decision will be out sometime in June. Links to the transcript and other court documents are at our website, alaskapublic.org. Alaska Senator Mark Begich put a hold on the promotion of an Air Force general last week, citing frustration with the lack of answers about the proposed move of the F-16 fighter squadron from Eielson Air Force Base to Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson.
We are sitting here now, several months later, with no new information. They have not proven the cost savings that they say are there. They have not shown us the impacts to the families. We're done waiting, and we're going to put the pressure on them. And one way to do it is tell them they're not getting any more of their people in the Pentagon, and until they respond to us and give us the appropriate information.
The senator says he'll keep the hold on the nomination process for Lieutenant General Herbert Hawk Carlisle until the Air Force provides specific answers about the impact of the move on civilian personnel and the effect on the Fairbanks community.
We have hundreds of families up there in limbo trying to figure out, one, are they going to move from the base they're at? But on top of that, the whole community of Fairbanks, the small businesses that work with the military up there, the educational facilities up there, in a sense of kids who go to school, it's all in limbo because the Air Force is not forthcoming with the information.
Senator Begich sent letters to Defense Secretary Leon Panetta and the leadership of the Senate Armed Services Committee requesting an analysis of potential cost savings to the military. The Air Force plans to present a finalized plan for the move by May 31st. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, another year, another flood on the Tanana River near Salcha.
At least every other year recently, there are issues with ice jam flooding in this exact location.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for nearly 60 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. CrowleyAlaska.com. And by Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
The Election Commission for the Municipality of Anchorage is holding a final public meeting this evening to interview voters. They're talking to people who are concerned about their question ballot being counted or who were unable to vote in the April 3rd municipal election due to ballot shortages. The commission began interviewing voters Saturday at the Lusac Library. KSKA's Daisha Eaton was there and filed this report.
Dozens of voters sat down with members of the Election Commission in the Lusac Library Wilda Marsden Theater to tell their stories in one-on-one interviews. Jed Whitaker was one of them. He voted a question ballot, and he was angry to find out that his vote was not counted. He argued with Commission member Sue Kinney.
You are required to follow election law, and you didn't do it.
We did.
No, you didn't.
Well, you have to address that.
No. Tell me how you follow election law when you do not count my vote.
Sir,
tell me
I'm
how.
I'm going to sit here and argue with you.
About half the precincts ran out of ballots during the April 3rd municipal election, resulting in a huge number of question ballots. And some voters reported they were turned away at the polls. Mandy Gershon was an election worker at Muldoon Baptist Temple. She brought a list of names of people she had to turn away and described the chaos on election night.
We ran out of question ballot envelopes, so I went to Creekside to find out what they were doing. They said they were taking a list of names, so I started doing that once I got back. But then I ran to Muldoon Elementary because I knew they had put in a request for more question ballot envelopes because they had borrowed some of ours. They hadn't recopped yet, so we tried going to Bartlett, and they only had five left, so they weren't going to share. So I went back and started making a list of names, but by then the chairman was telling people they couldn't vote there.
Other voters and election workers reported trouble reaching the clerk's office with questions on voting day, broken seals on AccuVote memory cards, and running out of ballots and envelopes. Gwen Matthew is the chairman of the Election Commission. She says the commission is collecting as much information as possible.
We are here to ascertain if they were able to vote or if they weren't, how they were processed, that type of thing. We're also interviewing precinct chairs to find out what went on in their precinct that day. We're attempting to find a qualified answer, an idea of how many people actually were unable to vote, And from this mass of information that we're collecting, we will make recommendations to the Assembly.
The ACLU of Alaska is collecting sworn affidavits from people who say they could not vote and calling on the Anchorage Assembly to appoint an independent investigator. The Assembly says they're waiting on a report from the Commission before making a decision. Matthew says it will likely be another week before the Commission presents their report to the Assembly. Today's special meeting is the last opportunity to be interviewed by the Election Commission in person. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
After nearly 7 months camped out at a downtown park, Occupy Fairbanks has taken down its tents. The move follows a notice from the Fairbanks North Star Borough last week threatening legal action if the group refused to clear out of the park, where overnight camping is not allowed. Occupy Fairbanks member William White says the group anticipated having to call it quits.
We expected to relocate, tourist season, even though we've becoming probably one of the most photographed spots in town. The Alaska Tours bus was here last Saturday and all snapping their cameras.
White says Occupy Fairbanks knew groups had the park reserved for events this spring and summer. He says they were prepared to share the venue.
We're all along trying to be good neighbors and better neighbors than the bank. Some of the articles of coming out from Goldman Sachs investors, their articles said more than we could ever say how toxic the guys they work with and how they refer to their clients as Muppets. And we're just responding to that economic war is the equivalent.
Despite the decision to move out of Veterans Park, White says Occupy Fairbanks isn't giving up and will continue without a downtown encampment.
A lower profile, I don't think they really have to be in your face getting your attention any longer because they've gotten enough attention.
Occupy Fairbanks plans to participate in a national general strike planned for May 1st. There is a flood advisory in effect on the Tanana River until 11 p.m. this evening for the Salcha area, southeast of Fairbanks. National Weather Service hydrologist Ed Plum says an advisory isn't uncommon this time of year.
This is an, I don't want to say annual event, but at least every other year. Recently, there are issues with ice jam flooding in this exact location.
Plum says flooding is posing problems at the construction site of the new Tanana River Railroad Bridge. That project includes a new levee, which may alleviate problems with flooding in the future.
Well, the idea is once they build this levee, that actually pile driver slough will be essentially blocked off entirely from the main part of the Tanana River. You may still have groundwater effects. If the Tanana River is running high, that water will seep underneath the levee, but the idea is that you won't have water flowing over bank into pile driver slough and then flowing into, properties and over the old Richardson Highway any longer.
Plum says that the ice on the Tanana was slightly thinner than normal this winter, but that doesn't necessarily prevent ice jams and flooding. He adds that the riverbank near Salcha has been eroded over the years, making the area more susceptible to flooding.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. The Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com. And by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the Trans-Alaska Pipeline with over 700 employees.
The Museum of the North in Fairbanks is now home to a rare stone that's made its way back to the state of Alaska decades after it was taken from Shemya Island in the Aleutian Chain. The stone is covered in petroglyphs, but as KUAC's Emily Schwing reports, lots of research hasn't uncovered their secrets.
The basement of the Museum of the North is filled with dead animals, old furniture, valuable paintings, and a wide range of artifacts.
So this is the collections range where all of the collections for all the different departments are stored here.
Archaeology collection manager Jim Whitney leads the way to one corner where a large wooden crate rests on the floor. Whitney unscrews the lid and slides it off. Inside rests a dark gray lumpy stone shaped like a halibut. It's 3 feet across, and it weighs a few hundred pounds. One corner comes to a distinct point. This is the Seal Stone.
That's the name that was given it to it by the people who had it for over 50 years. They called it the Seal Stone because of this petroglyph on the end here, which is clearly a face which resembles, in their opinion, a seal.
Archaeologists believe the Seal Stone is originally from Shemya Island, which is just east of Attu at the very tip of the Aleutian Chain. This is only the second example of its kind in 100 years of archaeological work on the Aleutians.
When you remove an artifact from its context, you lose a lot of information about the people who made that piece. At the same time, in this case, Shemya Island was heavily used during World War II as an airbase, and a lot of sites were just completely destroyed. So perhaps if this piece hadn't been collected, then it would have been just completely lost forever.
For 50 years, the Seal Stone was used as a lawn ornament until the owners tried to sell it, and eventually it made its way back to Alaska. The stone is covered in carvings or petroglyphs, but the intricate designs are hard to see without a good light, so Whitney plugs in a small lamp.
If you use raking light, you can really see that they kind of just jump out at you a little bit more. So here's the face at the end of the stone. On this side is, let's see if we can get the light to show it, which is a sort of oblong shape that has been perhaps tentatively identified as a sea otter. And then at the very end, there's this sort of odd-shaped design, which is a large circle with a stem coming off of it of some kind here.
Archaeologists haven't identified every petroglyph yet. Some of the carvings have been linked to stories from the Aleut culture. But Whitney says there's more research to be done.
One thing we'd like to do as part of the research as well is actually connect with those communities from the Aleutian Islands, talk to them about what these pieces of the art mean to them, or what the different design elements mean to them.
The museum plans to put the Seal Stone on permanent display by the end of next year, but only after several research projects are complete and as soon as they figure out just how to illuminate it. In Fairbanks, I'm Emily Schwing.
Alaska lost two well-known and much-loved acoustic musicians during the past year. Juno's Buddy Tabor and Skagway's Barb Kalin sang, strummed, and put together musical events during their many years in the region. Both were celebrated at the Alaska Folk Festival, a 7-day series of concerts held this month in the capital city. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld gives us a taste of the sound of their tributes.
Barb Kalin spent her nearly 90 years of life in Skagway. She was a homesteader and a political activist. She worked as a photographer, botanist, and reporter, and she raised a family. For many, she'll be best remembered as a musician and organizer of concerts and festivals. Kalin and some of her favorite singers and instrumentalists played the Alaska Folk Festival under the name Skagway Beach Picnic. Friends, including Juno's Martha Stay, resurrected that group to celebrate her life.
Barb loved it when everybody sang along. Please honor her spirit, and your parts will be painfully obvious. Barb Kalin was born up in Northland Canal.
In old Skagway.
Was there she was born, and she raised all her own
in old Skagway.
Kalin frequently held impromptu music gatherings in her hometown, and she put together the International Folk Festival with concerts one night in Skagway and the next in Whitehorse. It helped make long-lasting connections between Alaska and Yukon pickers and singers.
The other day,
I met a bear.
Out in the woods.
Away out there.
The other day, I met a bear. Out in the woods, away up there.
Martha Stay, her husband Jim, Ann Fuller, and other musicians, including Kalin's daughter, gathered around a large photograph at the festival to sing a medley of some of Kalin's favorite songs.
Music alone shall live, music alone shall live, music alone shall live, never to die.
Rest in peace, Barb Kalin.
One of the first people to back Kalin up on the festival stage was Juno's Buddy Tabor, who also recently passed away. Many Alaska Folk Festival performers dedicated songs or sets this year to the singer, songwriter, poet, and guitarist. One of the tributes came from Will Putman of Fairbanks. He met Tabor years ago on his first ferry ride north.
And then I met him every year when I came back to this festival. And I don't know if I could even say I really knew Buddy well, except that I had 30 years worth of really intense conversations, widely scattered once a year. And I think this was one of his more popular numbers. But it really struck a chord with me, the stark simplicity, the battle of life and death, the despair, and the bad ending that Buddy was known for. The last thing they told me was, Billy, the ice is too thin. But I wouldn't listen, and just like a fool, I fell in.
Tabor, most recently a house painter, was not shy about giving his fellow musicians advice. Juno's Colette Costa was among those with a teasing friendship. She said Tabor liked to tell her to sing without putting on a show. So she named her festival group Costa's Angel Band, a.k.a. Hootenanny in Heaven, and filled the stage with musicians and dancers.
Well, I guess the only upside is that this is actually a Buddy Tabor song. I don't think he ever envisioned it this way. He referred to the song as a ditty, a throwaway fool. If your love were a lace, sweet chocolate divine, I'd wrap around this heart of mine. You give me a kiss, too sweet and fine. Come on, daddy, be my valentine.
Costa closed her set by bringing a red robe choir to the stage to share her take on one of Tabor's favorite hymns.
Just a closer walk with thee.
This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting from the 38th Alaska Folk Festival in Juneau.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Emily Schwing and Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Daisha Eaton in Anchorage, and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Fite. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Bristol Bay Native Corporation, generations of jobs, heritage, and history. Bristol Bay, a place that's always been. Online at bbnc.net. Home, it's where you lay your head, eat home-cooked meals, and gather with friends. Home is where you grew up and learned about life. Alaska is home, and when you choose to violate someone by committing sexual assault, you harm them, and you harm yourself, your friends, your family, your home, and Alaska. No one deserves to be sexually assaulted, so make the right choice. Real Alaskans choose respect. This message brought to you by the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. The grocery store meltdown. We've all seen it. Harried and frustrated mom, tired toddler in full tantrum mode, and out of nowhere comes a young stock clerk. Drops to his knees next to the screaming child and starts rolling cans and making funny noises. The diversion works. Distracted from his tantrum, the toddler stops crying. Mom takes control and finishes her shopping. Families are stronger when others take an interest. This message sponsored by Best Beginnings, Alaska's Children's Trust, and Strengthening Families Alaska.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.